Blog Talk Radio.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Everybody, welcome to the Dynamic Dojo Talk Radio Show with Christina and Robert. It's September 8th, 2013, and we are broadcasting live from Seattle, Washington. And as always, I am joined with the best co-host in the world and my brother in martial arts, Chico, Robert Siegel. Chico Bob, how are you doing this evening?
Hey, I'm doing wonderful. Thanks so much for asking. Had an interesting night last night. Martial Arts Museum Hall of Honors.
Tell us about it. I'm so excited to hear about it.
You know,
okay.
there was about 200 people or so there, all dressed in nines. You know, we had Sidekick Publications was there. It was a good fundraising event because, of course, the museum is a nonprofit organization. They had a lot of worker bees going around. Everyone was called up individually, not like a typical Hall of Fame maybe where they would call up groups at a time. Made it very interesting. We got to talk a little bit. Like I told you earlier, you know, they would show a picture of the inductee coming up with their name on it. And they picked the one I didn't want them to choose. They picked the one where I still had no hair. I wanted them to pick the one like when I was 28 and I had this flowing head of hair like my profile picture on Facebook. And then there was this girl I met last night. She was the one who got everybody on deck. Her name is Susan DeCarl. And she was dressed in Asian garb, almost like a geisha looking type dress. And what she was doing was going around when somebody was up accepting their award, she would be pulling the next one up.
Oh, cool.
So it made it, it still ended 45 minutes late probably. Dinner started late. They didn't bring dinner out probably for 10, 15 minutes after the salad was served. So they were really slow. So that made them start the event before dinner was finished.
Oh, I bet that's kind of awkward where you're like still chewing or so, you know, and you get called up.
Yeah. I was 64th out of 70, so I was done with dessert and I'm like my third cup of coffee by that point.
Wow.
The awards were great. The certificate was nice. The trophy was unbelievable. A nice crystal trophy, almost looked like a miniature Washington Monument.
Oh, cool.
With your name on it. It was very, very well done. Very, very thought out. And I really enjoyed myself. There were some people I haven't seen in a long time that I reconnected with. Our guest from that's on the show next week when you have your seminar that you're not going to be on the show next week, William Christopher Ford. He was also inducted. He was there last night.
Very cool.
I hooked back up with Peter Cunningham, Sugarfoot.
And it was
funny. So, when somebody was on stage, they would recognize the people they see in the audience, possibly. And one guy says, "I can't believe it. There's Peter Sugarfoot Cunningham." And he says, "What's really funny? What's the other foot called?" It was a comedy night. It was fun. I enjoyed it. I also hooked up again with Cecil Peoples that I haven't seen in years since he used to do his March Madness tournaments that I used to judge at. Both Cecil and Peter, which are very nice guys. Great guys. They both consented to do our show.
I am so excited about that. You don't know how excited I am about that because, like, you know, back in the day, when I say back in the day, I don't mean like dinosaur age listeners, okay? But back in the day, Sugarfoot was one of the household words when it came to sport karate. I mean, you know, Sugarfoot, everyone knew who Sugarfoot was.
Oh yeah, and he was an actor. He doubled for Eddie Murphy in the movie I mm-hmm. Spy, where Eddie Murphy played a boxer.
Mm-hmm.
And the
I
guy
can
move like he couldn't believe. And I would love to talk to these people. I bet he has stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
That are unbelievable.
Yeah. So stay tuned,
now,
listeners,
for
that.
I'm sorry, what?
I was telling the listeners to stay tuned for upcoming news as to when those gentlemen will be on the show.
Oh, absolutely. I Facebook both of them through email, and they'll get back to me very, very quickly. I still have Pete's phone number, so I can
awesome.
Get a call. It was a great night. You know, I saw Dan Hecht was sitting right next to me. David Dye was there, and you know both of us. We see
mm-hmm.
them maybe once a year.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
It was just very, 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 very good night.
Very cool. Well, congratulations, Bob, and to Hanchi Den and William Christopher Ford and everyone that was. I looked at the list last night, and I was like, oh, my gosh, that's a big list.
That was very good. There were 115 people, I believe, nominated, and 70 of us were there.
Yeah, that's a big list. So congratulations. Yeah.
But there is an event you're going to in February. Why don't you tell us about it?
Okay. It is. Well, I put me on the spot.
Absolutely.
In February 2014 in Orlando, Florida, near SeaWorld. In fact, I think it's at a hotel near SeaWorld or in SeaWorld. The Association of Women Martial Arts Instructors, and I hardly say that all drawn out like that because I know it as AME, the Association of Women's Martial Arts Instructors, which started out as a national group, but if I remember correctly, has gone probably global. I don't remember. I'd have to check other past years to see if international women instructors had come to the annual conference, but I was nominated into the Hall of Fame for the Association of Women's Martial Arts Instructors by board members Kimberly Ivey and Zosia Gorbaty. And what a surprise it was. I get this email from Sensei Zosia, and it pretty much says, you know, just wondering if you wanted to be a presenter. And, you know, I'd been asked, you know, in years past to be a presenter, and I just couldn't, my schedule wouldn't allow it. And I figured, okay, you know, and I decided when I just saw that sentence, do you want to be a presenter, that, okay, I'll do it this year. I think I can do it. And then a few sentences down, it said that I was nominated. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? So I'm going to I accepted and put in my application for membership, for lifetime membership into the Association of Women's Martial Arts Instructors. And as a presenter, I had to come up with a proposal for a possible 4 classes that I'd be teaching. And I'm like, God, what do I want to offer this time around so that I haven't already taught at the Pacific Association of Women's Martial Arts, you know, annual
right.
gathering. But, yeah, but, you know, sometimes, though, you know, some ladies show up at AME that didn't get a chance to APAMA. So I figured, oh, okay, well, that's fine. So anyhow, so that's where I'm going to be. I'm going to go to Florida in February and get inducted into their Hall of Fame. It'll be fun.
You know, and you and I are involved in so much the same aspects. We're involved in USCMAS and the Masters, and I got inducted last night into the Honor Society. This organization that you're going to be inducted into, this is going to separate us.
It's the only organization you can't get into.
That's right. I won't be at PAMA. I won't be at the Association of Women Martial Arts Instructors. I want our listeners to know absolutely something, Rusty, that you will promote everybody in the world except one. Do you know who that is?
Me. I second promoting myself.
Steeple Rusty is trying to get out there and promote her own seminar circuit. So if you're interested, if you're in the Seattle area, or if you're not, contact her on Facebook. She'll be happy to come out and do a seminar in many different styles. In a screamer, bullwhip, tai chi, qigong,
kempo.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking about it because she can be called Sifu, Sensei, Guru. Just like a lot of us have different titles.
Thanks, bro. Thanks. So yeah, I am. You know, I'd like to get out there and do that. And with the advent of several students moving out of state, I think seminars are going to have to be the way to go, because one of my students recently moved out to Oregon. He wants to set up his own school. And I said, okay, let's do it. You're going to bring me and Guru Cheryl out, like, you know, once every 6 months, right? Right? Okay. So, yeah, I figured, you know, I'll open myself up for seminars and stuff, just because. You know, as my mom would say, you never know, you could get hit by a bus tomorrow. You might as well share everything. So I'm like, okay.
That's right. But you also have to have the driving force behind you.
Right. And that's you.
where you actually taste tennis shoe leather, because I've got my foot up your butt.
Yep, and that's you, because I just, you know, I know there are other martial artists out there that are just like me. You know, we're good at doing what we do right here, and you know, that's what we concentrate on. But you know, sometimes when people say you should get out there and, you know, share, it's like, I suck at promoting myself. I can promote everybody else just fine. I suck at promoting myself. So, you know, with that said,
and that's why I put you on the spot. I don't give you a choice.
Seminar circuit too. And in fact, you know what I think we should do, Bob, is every now and again when we're in the same state, we should see about doing joint seminars.
That's a thought.
Maybe. I don't know. Something. I don't know. It's just a thought. But anyway, let's get on with the show. Our phone number here is 347-677-0699. Let's go ahead and get started so our listeners don't sit there and fall asleep on us. So let's start with our birthdays like we normally do. Yay. So
yay.
Yay. So today is the birthday of a very good friend of ours, April Vidal. Happy birthday, April. And tomorrow, September 8th, is Anshu Stephen Hayes' birthday. Now, for people that aren't familiar with Stephen Hayes, and if you aren't familiar with Stephen Hayes, then, wow, how long have you been doing martial arts? he is considered a shidoshi in Tokakure Ryu Ninjutsu, and he actually is the director of a, for lack of a better term, a hermitage, and I've forgotten where this retreat is located. I completely forgot the state that it's located in. But he and his wife, Rumiko, are the Anshu, or the directors of the of that particular retreat. So happy birthday, Shidoshi Stephen. And let's move on to September 12th. That's a Thursday. Sifu Kim Ivy, who was a previous guest of ours on the internal art episode, is having her birthday, as well as Sensei Shirley Keith. And then on September 14th, Master Tony Adderhold is having his birthday. So those are my shout-outs to them. And, Bob, I know you've got a couple of people that you want to place shout-outs to for their birthdays.
I do have three, and two of them have actually been guests on the show.
Hmm?
On the 10th, it's going to be Tim Wesky's birthday, and he was a guest on our show when we did an East versus West. He was our fence. He was representing fencing.
Mm-hmm.
And on 9/11, it's Patrick McDaniel's birthday, a Keju Campo brother from North Carolina. He's also been on the show. And Anna Gracie on 9/13, she will also be celebrating her birthday at that time.
Right on. Very cool. So happy birthday to all of those people. And for anyone else that we missed Sorry about that. We want to be able to get as many people on our list as possible, but usually I only have about 10 minutes to get our show together. But here's a special tune for all of you. Happy birthday to all our Facebook and martial art friends out there. Right on. All right. So we want to do a few more shout-outs based on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page. And to our listeners out there, if you're a fan of the show and haven't yet joined the page on Facebook, please do. That way you can get information on all of our upcoming shows and also some interesting news, too. We don't only post about the show. We post other stuff as well. And we invite our page members to post their events and other interesting news as well. But I do want to do a shout out to Lauscher Dennis Mace. He's a licensed massage practitioner here in Washington State, and he's doing a Bagua Zhang workshop series. And this series is called Moving Meditation, Bagua Zhang, the Circular Art of Transformation. And these are introductory workshops. He's got one coming up on September 21st, starting at 2 p.m. at the Chandao Kung Fu here in Renton, Washington, which is located at 231 Main Avenue South, Renton, Washington, 98057. And on October 6th, Laoshi Mace is having a intro workshop at 3 p.m. at East West Bookshop in Seattle, Washington, which is located at 6500 Roosevelt Way Northeast in Seattle, 98115. Now, all the info and how to get directions to these locations are on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page, and the information is posted by Dennis Mace. So go check that out. Right on. And back to the page, we've got, oh, I don't know how I got on that page. I typed in Dynamic Dojo, and all of a sudden I can't get to our page for some reason. I don't know what's going on. Oh, I see why. Because Dynamic Dojo, when I type this in, it pulls up a page that's listed in Burbank, California, and I'm like, what's going on? All right. So let's see here. Oh, Bob, wasn't there a tournament coming up that you had told me about?
It's really cool. It's an open tournament, but not completely. It's mm-hmm. for kids only.
Oh, very cool.
OCR, National Kids Only Tournament.
Mm-hmm.
You can check out their webpage. It's OCJRNationals.com. Mm-hmm. It's September 15th at Brea on Linda High School at 7, mm-hmm. 8, and 9. Wildcat Way in the city of Brea, 92821. This is a really cool idea. Just have a kids tournament.
Yeah.
That's
very
cool. So cool.
Very cool. I like that. Very cool. Awesome. All right. And our next shout out is, I had posted this video on our page about Fumio Demura. And it's an actual movie. It's a movie trailer, actually. It's called The Real Miyagi. And it's all about Fumio Demura. Now, you know, Fumio Demura was a driving force in making karate popular in the United States. I shouldn't say popular, but he was one of the big names, because karate was already in the United States when Fumio Demura came on the scene. But Fumio Demura brought a different sense of showmanship and power and just the raw sense of karate to everyone that he's taught. And it's a great trailer. Go check it out. It's on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page. All right. I also want to do a shout-out to David C. Falcaro, who posted a trailer on Sogo Bujutsu. And it's kind of a teaser trailer, and it was meant to get people interested in coming to the school and getting involved with their Sogo Bujutsu school. And it's kind of cool. I've never seen anyone hip throw three people at the same time before. Have you? I've seen people throw people. And I've seen people throw, you know, people on this hand, people on that hand, kind of like Hapkido, you know, Aikido, that kind of thing. But never three people over the same hip or the same shoulder. It was pretty interesting. I was like, oh my gosh, that's pretty cool. So go check that out on the Dynamic Dojo Facebook page posted by David Falcaro. Another upcoming tournament, October 13th, is the 7th Annual Kids Classic. It's another tournament only for kids. And I don't know why I said October 13th. It's October 12th. That's what I get for typing. But it's October 12th at Mount Pleasant High School in San Jose, California. And it's open to all kids ages 16 and under of all styles, any level. And you can register online at kidsclassic.stormline.com. Stormline, as in STORMLINE, kidsclassic.stormline.com. And they're actually giving away bicycles to junior grand champion divisions in kata sparring and self-defense. So go check it out. I mean, in any division. I mean, they got jiu-jitsu divisions. They got flag sparring divisions, Chinese Kung Fu and Wushu divisions, Muay Thai, sport kickboxing, karate, Kung Fu, the whole nine yards. So, wow, if you're in the San Jose area on October 12th, go check it out. And this is being put on by Alan and Liz Garcia. So, wow, check that out. And this particular event had already passed, but I do want to just place a verbal in-person, so to speak, shout-out to Jiu-Jitsu America and the U.S. Judo Association on their 35th anniversary. So congratulations to them. And I think that's it for my shout-outs, Bob, finally. Do you have any shout-outs on your end?
No, I'm good.
Okay, awesome. Well, I guess we could move on to our health news. All right. Now, this is about lack of sleep. Lack of sleep. Now, a lot lately, me included, I've seen a lot of my friends posting on Facebook or Twitter like at 3 in the morning, and I'm one of them because sometimes I just can't get to sleep, and this is why I decided to talk about this. We've all heard that lack of sleep can cause health issues, so a common question is, can a lack of sleep actually cause diseases? Well, the answer, according to this article in the Bismarck Tribune, says that effects from lack of sleep can cause many problems, ranging from quality of life issues such as daytime fatigue and hindered driving skills, all the way to health-related developments such as increased risk for heart disease, high blood pressure, depression, obesity, and even early death. The lack of sleep is also attributed to more than 7% of serious workplace accidents. Sleep affects our ability to think, react, remember, and solve problems. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than 25% of Americans experience sleeplessness periodically, and about 10% have chronic insomnia. Now, does insomnia go away? Well, it can be short-term, and you may have periods where you have no sleep problems, then bam, sleeplessness returns again. Chronic insomnia is defined as experiencing sleeplessness at least 3 nights a week for a month or more. Now, a lot of people will ask, well, yeah, I have trouble sleeping, but what actually causes it? Well, many factors can contribute to sleeplessness. Among them are life stress. Among them are not being able to talk. Anyway, among them are life stressors such as job changes, the death of someone we love, etc. Also, medical conditions such as pain, certain medications, and noises can interfere with sleep. Other things such as schedule changes and substance abuse are other common contributors. Now, if you suffer from insomnia, it's not just a lack of sleep that is likely to be the problem. People with insomnia often worry about sleeping, feeling chronically tired and irritable, are sleepy during the daytime, and have trouble with concentration, irritability and moodiness, as well as physical problems like headaches and stomach aches. Have you ever done that, Bob, where you can't sleep and you keep looking at the clock going, gosh darn it, I got to get to sleep, and you just don't? Have you ever done that?
Oh, absolutely, and it's like 2 or 3 hours later.
Yeah, and then you only get like two hours of sleep, and then you're just good for nothing the next day.
For example, last night after the ceremony, I got home at like, I didn't get home. I got home at like 11, but I went to sleep about 12:30. My damn dog wakes me up to go outside at 2:30. Mm-hmm. I was up till almost 5.
Oh, gosh, that sucks.
Oh, yeah.
Now, people will ask, though, well, what can I do to sleep better? What can I do to prevent insomnia? Okay, well, some
alcohol.
Of the tips are. Yeah. Actually, that keeps me up. It makes me feel like I want to go to sleep, right, just because it's a sedation thing, right? But then after a while, like, if I actually stay up after it, like, kind of wears off a little bit, then that's it. I'm up and I can't get to sleep. It's weird. But
you know how to solve that problem?
What's that? Drink more?
Yep.
That's right. Drink more. Well, we'll go with what the Bismarck Tribune says for right now.
Okay.
So the Tribune says that you want to eat a light evening meal, which is hard for me because, you know, I'm Filipino. You know, we eat all the time. And me eating at midnight is no problem. Now, if you're hungry before bedtime, eat a light snack. Another thing that you can do to sleep better is do something that relaxes you before bedtime, such as reading, listening to music, or taking a hot bath. Make sure that your bedroom is sleep-friendly. Turn your clock away from you so you don't watch it. Set the thermostat at a comfortable temperature. Eliminate as much light as possible. And if noise or light bothers you, try a sleep mask or use earplugs. Or you can disguise the noise with a fan. If you can't fall asleep, just get up and read or do something non-stimulating until you feel sleepy again. Now, the thing is, though, is if insomnia becomes chronic and it does start causing health problems or it does prevent you from functioning, when should you see a doctor? Well, you want to see a doctor if this insomnia continues over a period of a month or two. Now, if it's chronic, it can be a sign of serious disease, so definitely go see your primary care doctor. Now, before you see your doctor, though, it's suggested that you keep a sleep diary and record everything related to your sleep habits, such as the time you go to bed, number of times you wake up, or instances where you can't get to sleep, the amount of sleep you actually do get, and on and on. That way you have something to give your doctor when you go see them, and it'll better allow the doctor to come to a better diagnosis to the extent of your problems. Now, in some cases, though, your doctor might recommend a sleep study to determine if there is indeed a medical reason for you having this insomnia. Lifestyle and behavioral changes, prescription medications, and other medical aids that can help you sleep well might also be prescribed by your doctor. So anyway, that's just a little tidbit on how sleep or lack of it can affect your life and your health. So try to get some sleep out there, folks. All
very
right.
Cool.
Well, yeah. Well, let's move on to
weird news.
Now, this I will be brief because we have gone long on this segment. I do want to remind any listeners on hold that when Guru Mark Makita comes on and you want to talk, please press the number 1 on your phone. That will let us know that you want to actually speak with our guests instead of just listening to the show, which we do appreciate as well. Now, in England, in London, it says chivalry might be dead, or at least the romance is dead, in the case of a first date gone sour. London man, Kishore Namalia, 32, allegedly snatched his date's phone after she refused to pay for their bar tab, the Telegraph reported. Fakara Sultana, which was his date, who met Namalia on a dating website, Zeus, says she thought it was her date's duty to pay the £54 bar tab, which equates to $84 US. Until Penn refused to help pay the tab, Nemalia allegedly followed her before stealing her BlackBerry phone and then bolting off, according to the Mirror. Now, when I say according to the Mirror, these are other reporters, you know, papers, other news. Ms. Sultana screamed and ran after him. Prosecutor Helen Thomas said two passing policemen joined the chase and eventually caught him. Nemalia, who has been charged with one count of theft, told Southwark Crown Court jurors that he intended to give the phone back as soon as his date helped pay for the pricey drink, according to the Daily Mail.
Wow.
The trial is ongoing. This is funny. It is unclear if there is going to be a second date.
Why did he get all pissy about that? I mean, didn't he even think about, oh, I don't know, maybe going Dutch? I'll pay for my drinks. How about you pay for yours? I mean.
That's right. Now, in today's society, though, that's great if there is an understanding up front.
Yeah.
But I guess there wasn't. And typically the woman says, I'm the woman. You pay for the date.
Right.
Period. And $84 for two people, that's a lot of booze. I'm sorry.
I don't care where you go,
that's a lot.
I don't care where you go. I know, I was going to say the same thing. I don't care where you go, even with food. You know, that's
right.
A lot on just for drinks and food and junk. That's crazy.
This is funny. This is my last U.S. weird laws for the show.
Oh,
I have ran out of state. This is for Wyoming.
Wyoming.
Using a firearm to fish is strictly prohibited. And it's cheating.
That's crazy.
You may not take a picture of a rabbit from January to April without an official permit.
Whoa.
Well, that sucks.
Huh.
It is illegal for women to stand within 5 feet of a bar while drinking. That's also called consuming alcohol in public. That's also a crime as well.
I got to play this again. Hold on.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And that is my weird laws for the week. I think next week it's going to start European laws. And when we have Richard Norton on in 2 weeks, I think I'm going to do Australia weird laws because he does live in Melbourne now.
That would be cool. Awesome. And that was Bob.
Weird News.
All right. Let's go to the trivia question of the week. Now, how this works, listeners, is if you are the first caller with a correct answer, you get to win a chance to be a guest co-host on an upcoming episode with me and Sifu Bob, or you get to be a guest on your own. So all you have to do is be the first caller with a correct answer, or you can post in our chat board. We have a chat board underneath the Blog Talk Radio show marquee, if you're listening live, and you can type your answer there. So here is the trivia question of the week. What classic text is considered as the Bible of Karate? We want the name of the text. So let me repeat that. What is the name of the classic text that is considered the Bible of Karate? Our phone number here is 347-677-0699. We hope to hear from the first caller. Now, if you do call, please press 1 so we know that you want to talk to us. All right. Well, that's it for the trivia of the week and our weird news, health news, and shout out. So why don't we go ahead and do this? I want to play a musical piece. I got to find one. Hold on. Okay, I found one. I want to play a musical piece for a short 4.5-minute break. And in that time, Sifu Bob and I are going to go into our green room and we're going to call our guest and get our guest on the line. Our guest is going to be Guru Mark Mikita of Mikita School of Martial Arts and Fightology. So in about 4.5 minutes, you'll get a chance to talk to Mr. Mikita. So we'll be right back after this.
with the show.
All right, and we are back. If you're just now tuning in, this is the Dynamic Dojo Talk Radio Show with Rasita and Robert. Our phone number here is 347-677-0699. And we had just heard a tune called Crystallize by Lindsey Stirling. Now, I want to apologize to our listeners in advance if you heard some voices during the break because my green room line was tripping out on me. So if you heard someone going hello and can you hear me now, that was me messing up in the green room. So Sifu Bob, would it be possible if you could introduce our special guest for tonight?
It would be possible. I would like to bring on Guru Mark Makita of the Makita Martial Arts School of Vitology. I've known Guru Makita too. I'm afraid to actually say because then it's like we always do, it shows our age. But I've known Guru and studied with him about 25 years ago at Barnsdale Art Park in the city of Hollywood. I was introduced to him through my good friend, one of our past guests, Kent Turnipseed. Please help me welcome longtime martial artist, great instructor, Guru Mark Makita. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Thank you
Certainly
for taking the time out of your, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. Now, as always, me and Sifu Bob really like to give our listeners a little bit of a background on our guests. So if it's possible, Guru, can you tell our listeners about your martial arts background? It's a lengthy one, too, so I'm really excited about hearing all about your background.
Well, it's kind of hard to answer this question because the fundamental thing is that my father was in the military, so I moved a lot when I was a young man. So I started when I was 6 years old.
Wow.
And I continuously studied from that point forward, but understanding that basically elementary school starts when you're 6 years old, and I went to 15 elementary schools.
Whoa!
So that's a much removed. So a lot
yeah.
of moving around. So most people who look at the military brat thing think of it as a disadvantage. But to me, as a young man studying martial arts, I found it to be a great advantage because it essentially forced me to broaden my horizons as a martial artist and study with many, many, many different teachers. So. Sometimes I could only study with somebody for maybe 6 to 8 weeks, the length of time that my father was stationed in a particular base. So so oftentimes it was next to impossible to find that same art again because some of the arts were rather obscure. So I would basically just have to focus my education on learning principle because principle is being universal. It wouldn't really matter whether I went from one system to the next because universal principles always apply. So. That was literally an idea, a concept, an approach that was forced upon me by necessity of my circumstances. So it has served me well throughout my life as a martial artist and as a teacher, because I still to this day focus on principle. So
that's very cool.
But beyond that, with regard to experience, I study with so many different teachers, but I will tell you with regard to the Philippine martial arts, which I think a lot of people know me for teaching Filipino martial arts. My dad served in the Philippines in World War II. He landed on the beach of Leyte on October 20th, 1944 with MacArthur's forces, and he was only a kid at the time. But he spent the next year basically pursuing the Japanese all the way through to the northern part of the Philippines, and it was horrible and awful, and it's not pointed to go into those details, but my father continuously, for my entire youth of being interested in martial arts, continuously said, you need to find Filipino martial arts. Even though he didn't know what they were called, he just knew that he had followed Escrimidores, although he didn't know that's what they were called, he followed Escrimidores into the jungle in the Philippines, and saw some amazing warriors, and just for the rest of his life basically ranted about their courage and their honor and their basically invincibleness. So when I was 11, I finally, through his help, found a Filipino gunnery sergeant on the base and started studying Philippine martial arts. at that point. So, and I've been studying those arts ever since. So,
very cool.
But that's a long time now. A couple of weeks, as I always say.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting that you mentioned principle, because you know, Sifu Bob and I are firm believers in know the principle, right? It's not necessarily the style, it's the principle. But you know, there's always going to be, you know, somebody out there that'll be like, oh well, you know, if you haven't been studying karate for 30 years, then you know, you don't know it. You know? How do you deal with people like that?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you've met those kind of people, right? I don't have the patience for those kind of people.
There's a famous quote that has probably been misquoted over the centuries, but the quote is from Musashi, and he said, if you want to understand the blade, study the guitar.
Mm.
And his point was, don't be narrow-minded in your focus. Expand your horizons. Mm. And I mean, I've studied anatomy. I've studied anthropology. I've looked into all of these aspects of the art, because the art is certainly not just technique. It's certainly not how to make a fist or how to throw a particular kick or how to hold a stick in your hand. Those are, at the most, the rudiments of the art. But to become an artist, you've got to transcend the techniques and the kind of minutiae of the art and get into what is the medium of expression that you're trying to master. And that's beyond the level of any particular technique. And techniques are always going to be limited. Techniques are always going to be limited by the limitations of the individual. A person might be more flexible, they might be older, they might be younger, they might be in a wheelchair. I've talked about some handicapped folks. All of those people have the ability to master the art to a high level. Their limitations are only more obvious, but all of us have those limitations on some level. So.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I'm really glad that you're talking about that, and I'm pretty sure we're going to be talking more about your outlook on principle and how it applies to martial arts a little bit later. But in the meantime, I'm going to hand the mic over to Sifu Bob, because I think he has a question for you.
Okay. Well, girl, you stayed in the Philippines for a long time. What was it like for a Caucasian kid at that time, coming up in the Philippines, studying the Filipino martial arts, and did you have to learn Tagalog or any other dialect?
Well, the amount of training I've had with Filipinos, the teachers were all effectively conversant in English. And I say effectively conversant. They may not have been very eloquent, but they spoke with their hands and with their art rather than with their words. And I think that was really crucial. I think anybody who studied with a teacher who basically couldn't form a sentence in English and yet touched their lives and changed their lives for the better understands what I mean when I say that really the language can oftentimes be a barrier or an obstacle to really deep learning of the art. So. That's going to be different for people who are reliant upon language or upon explanation for the art, but I wasn't a person who needed necessarily to have it explained. It was more that I needed to feel it and I needed to see it done well. So for me, the explanation was a tertiary matter. So.
Mm. Very cool.
Now, were there any obstacles being a Caucasian that you had to overcome, or were you welcome with open arms?
I think in some ways there was a more positive energy toward the fact that I wasn't bringing with me the rivalries that are so rampant in the European culture. I was always and remain always respectful of every culture's contribution to the art. So whether you are Pangasinan or Tausug or Tagalog, mattered not one iota to me. It was only what was your contribution, what was your voice, and how did it add to my understanding?
Great. And being Filipino, I mean, I'm a Filipino-American. I don't speak Tagalog or Pangasinan or Cebuano or anything. Like, I can fake it really well, but I can't speak it.
Your pronunciation was really good.
You got that wonderful balance.
So.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it's, you know, I've been around it and, you know, being able to, I can't speak one dialect because here at home, it was a mixture of like 5 different dialects. So I never really got, you know, I never really got like the full language. But, you know, as far as our culture, you know, Filipinos are indeed very happy when anyone from outside of the Philippines wants to learn anything, especially Eskrima or Arnis or anything like that, because it shows that there's people, you know, elsewhere in the world that want a part of their culture. And,
sure.
you know, they'll just give it away. They'll just say, oh, here, just, you know, just buy me a... Just give me some cigarettes and a bottle of whiskey, and I'll teach you for a week. You know, it's
yeah.
so cool how that works.
You know,
that's really
I had
cool.
I had the experience of a teacher kind of looked sideways at me when I first approached him, because here I was, this the Hawaiians would say, I was this big howly. I was almost a foot and a half taller than the teacher. And he kind of looked sideways at me. So I brought him my father's liberation medal from the Philippine campaign. And I showed him a few pictures from that time, including this wonderful photograph of my father's scrapbook of a very attractive Filipino girl laying in the grass. And on the back of the picture, it says, Filipino baby. Now, I don't know what the story is there. but the teacher got such a kick out of it that I was in like Flynn at that point. So.
That's awesome. That is so awesome. And, you know, you said that you were, like, moving around a lot and stuff. But, see, if you weren't doing that, you wouldn't have all these wonderful experiences with all of these people that you've studied with. So it's stories like that that are just so enjoyable to hear. That's so awesome.
Yeah, and for me, actually, I have to add to that that oftentimes the sense that, I mean, I've actually heard people say that one master, one lifetime ideal. And this is a very 1960s kind of approach to martial arts. And but the fact is, you didn't study English with one teacher when you were in school.
Mm-hmm.
And each teacher gave that to you, that information, that knowledge, that understanding to you from their perspective, and their perspective added something to it that another teacher's perspective might not have. So they filled in a lot of gaps. They made it a broader, more comprehensive experience. Look at how artists train. They certainly don't train with one teacher.
Mm-hmm.
This notion in martial arts that one... I've never met a single teacher, and I've met some phenomenally skilled martial artists, and yet
mm-hmm.
I can say with all due respect that not one of them had all of the knowledge. It's just
mm-hmm.
not humanly possible.
Mm-hmm.
So you might speak 10 languages, but you don't speak 300 languages.
Mm-hmm.
So... The fact is that it isn't possible for them to have that broad of an understanding. And for me as an artist, and I certainly say this to all my students, I am the captain of my ship. I am the person who is creating my art for myself. And part
mm-hmm.
of that is exploring the art in the way that is most inspiring and the most moving to me as a martial artist. So
mm-hmm.
I know what works for me. I know what my limitations are. I know what my strengths are. I know what I gravitate toward. I know what is kind of uninteresting to me or is very passe to me at this point, and I steer my ship accordingly. So
mm-hmm.
the notion that my ship should be steered by somebody else is repulsive to me.
Mm.
So
I like that philosophy, you know, because, you know, I me and Bob both, and a lot of us that are listening have heard though, you know, one master, you know, for one lifetime, and you know, that can be interpreted so many different ways. It could be like you can only be with that master and study nothing else, or
yeah.
it can mean that your only loyalty should be to that person. And you know, and like you said, you know, no one knows everything. And, you know, out of all the people that I know, see who Bob studied under and I've studied under, I'm loyal to all of them.
Sure.
My loyalty is not going to go anywhere, right? So, you know,
and
they know that. They know that I'm not going to go anywhere and that I'm not going to, like, stab them in the back or anything like that. They know that. And I think that's why, you know, arts grow like yours. You know,
yeah.
you've innovated.
Yeah. I think that the one teacher, one lifetime thing basically is it reveals insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
Because if a teacher feels that you can't go and study with somebody else, I mean, if we just use our critical thinking and take off the white pajamas and take off all of the other stuff that
mm-hmm.
is imprisoning to so many people in their critical thinking abilities, and we ask ourselves, why would somebody not want me to go and ask questions about this art to someone else? It kind of becomes obvious. So the whole point is, This notion of loyalty can get twisted. It can get distorted into meaning you are now beholden to me. You are attached to my chain by your nose ring, and you're not allowed to ask questions. You're not allowed to inquire and expand your horizons beyond what I say is acceptable. And that is, I mean, let's go back to the 60s. This is what Bruce Lee was railing just 40 years ago. So, so the notion that anybody should be beholden to anyone in this realm is just ridiculous. And I've always been one to say, if you want to go and study with somebody else, please do. Come back and show me what you learned, and maybe I'll change my art. I want to be inspired. I want to be challenged. And my brother in the martial arts, longtime training partner, Robert will know who I'm talking about, Burton Richardson. We've known each other for 30 years, and Burton has something that he puts on all of his literature and so forth, and it's just an old saying, and I love it, and it applies absolutely in this case, and that is that the ship is safest in the harbor, but that's not what ships are for. So it certainly applies, and the notion that we should in any way, shape, or form follow just one person kind of reveals what that person's problems are, and as much as I love the martial arts, it's also full of a whole bunch of people that have very narrow focus and very narrow mind approaches to life. So
I agree. Agreed.
Well, you know what's funny, Sifu? When I went to go study with Guru Mark, my instructor at the time, my first calling instructor, told me, go, have fun, go
yeah.
to it. I went to him, I came back, and he chewed me out. And I said, you told me to expand my horizons. And he looked me in the eye and said, I didn't think you were going to really do it.
So he was willing to crack the door open, but he was just bluffing, I guess. So.
Oh, my goodness. That's funny. Yeah, you know, like several of my instructors pretty much, you know, said the same thing. You know, yeah, sure, go check it out, you know. Check it out.
Well, it should be that way.
Yeah.
And I think in helping other martial artists to become teachers and encouraging them to expand the horizons of their own students, I've always said, become a home for your students. Don't become a prison. If you're home, if you allow them to feel like they can jump off and expand their own horizons and explore what is interesting to them, they will always want to come back and share it with you. If you imprison them, they will only want to escape.
Exactly. I love that philosophy. I do a lot. Now, well, we'll get back to that philosophy. Me and Bob can talk about that forever. But let's get to actual tactics and strategy. You know, me and Bob want to kind of get your take on it. Now, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your outlook on the real-time relationship of the concepts of, wow, Bob, why did you put this word in here? What's exigency mean, Bob?
Urgent need.
Urgent need. Yeah, emergency. Okay, so we'll just say exigency. I was like, what the heck is that word?
Exigency circumstances would be emergency circumstances, something where things have become dire, like a 9.5 earthquake.
Oh, okay. Got it. Well, see, I learned a new word today. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about the relationship of the concepts of exigency to strategy and of strategy to tactics, tactics to weapons, and finally weapon to target?
Boy, this is how long of a show?
We've got another hour, sir. We've got another hour, sir. And, you know, and I would love it if listeners would call in with questions, too, because, you know, it's not often that we get to talk to teachers, you know, that have, you know, a very open sense of teaching and learning. So,
sure.
347-677-7609.
If we have an hour and you don't interrupt me and nobody calls in, I might be able to just barely scratch the surface.
Great.
Let's see about scratching that scratched surface then.
Well, let's try to simplify it, because I think that's a way to make people look at it further than they normally look, and that's the reason I wrote that, to get them to think about some of the stages of their own training, because we oftentimes think about how. That's what most classes are about: how to do it, how to do this, how to do that. It all becomes the how, but we very seldom talk about the why and the when. And those things are greatly important. A simple misstep that's based upon rote memorization in a class where everybody is encouraging you to do that could mean the difference between self-defense and punitive assault and 20 years in prison. So we need to be, again, teaching our students to have choices rather than to become automatic killing machines. Certainly if my grandmother comes up to me to surprise me and I hospitalize her, that's not something I want to develop. So so I constantly talk about the idea of developing choices. And the reverse of that, or the reciprocal of that, is that most people who come to me, whether they have training or not, are fraught with habits. And it's painted on the wall of my school that all habits are bad. Because anything that you do consistently, even if you do it very, very well, can be used against you. So it's the consistency, the habit of consistency, that actually makes you vulnerable, even if your techniques are as flawless as human beings can be. So I try to basically bring in the notion of unconscious tactics that people will naturally do with no training whatsoever. And actually, we have some pretty interesting exchanges in my school in that regard, especially with weaponry. I don't know if you've seen the painting on my wall. It's this sort of spontaneous, serendipitous mural on the wall of my school that I painted over a year period. One particular part of it is some Neanderthal men carrying large clubs, because we know as much as we can know that it's about 70,000 years B.C. is around the time when somebody decided to pick up a club and brain somebody else. So when it comes to martial arts, that's pretty much the oldest martial art there is.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody figured out that, well, if I don't have anything and he has a weapon, he has an advantage. Bingo, martial arts is born. And then, in the process of both of them picking up clubs and trying to figure out how not to get brained while they brain the other guy, now we start talking about tactics and strategy, and martial arts evolves and develops. So if I bring an untrained 60-year-old woman into my school, and it's not pointed whether it's a woman or a man or old or young, anybody basically comes into my school, and I give them a stick, could be a cane, could be an umbrella, could be a rattan stick, whatever it is, and I ask them to hit a target about the size of a softball, pretty much every person off the street can do it the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I said, I want you to do a spinning back kick and hit that same target, it would take sometimes months to get them to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great phrase in Latin, a priori, knowledge inherent.
Mm-hmm.
And that built-in knowledge of how to utilize that weapon comes from over 70,000 years of it being the way of defending yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never seen somebody not be able to do it. I've never seen an untrained person, when I put a weapon in their hand and I come at them with a weapon, I've never seen them not put up a defense with that weapon. And a defense that is pretty darn close to the exact way that we would teach them to do it. So that mm-hmm. knowledge is already intrinsically part of them. And we try to build upon that naturalness rather than trying to superimpose something that we think is theoretically smarter, that when we get their heart rate up to 120 or 220, and they're full of all the hormones that fear is going to pump them full of, they won't be able to do anything aside from what they were doing 70,000 years ago. So we want to keep it as simple and as base as possible, and then add to that some very intelligent but really simple, you can do it the first time you try it, kinds of technical adjustments and nuances of principle that will make you much, much more effective than somebody who just comes in off the street, who will invariably have the rudimentary capacity, but they won't have the developed skill. And so that's sort of how we approach it. We first of all, basically make them aware that they already possess this knowledge. Originally, mm-hmm. used to say that the job of a teacher is to show the student the cause of his own ignorance. And mm-hmm. that's essentially what I'm talking about, that we're going to get all of your preconceived notions and your belief systems out of the way of what you actually already are capable of doing, and give you access to it, teach you how to effectively employ it, and also how to holster it so that it doesn't employ you and put you in prison. So that's sort of the approach in a nutshell. Big nutshell.
That is so cool. Now, I'm looking at just one picture of this incredible mural. on your school's wall. And listeners out there, you need to check this school out, phytology.com. And the mural at your school is incredible. I mean, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, the weapons are part of this mural, and you know, you kind of look at it in 2D, in two dimensions, and you go, oh, those are great drawings of, wait, those are real foils.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And it's got like anatomy and all sorts of, even like historical fencing pictures from treatises and stuff like that on there. That's incredible. So yeah, I hope some of our listeners go check out your school if they have not already. So wow.
Well,
very cool.
One of the things I really constantly say to people, that as much as it's understandable that most people think of Asian fighting arts when they think of the concept or the idea of martial arts, I can't really think of a culture that hasn't had its own martial art.
Mm-hmm.
Several years ago, I was in the Czech Republic, and I was being interviewed by a Czech martial arts magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked a lot of the same kind of questions I usually get, how has it been to study so many different arts? And the young man who was interviewing me finally said, you know, you've studied so many things. Is there something you would like to study that you haven't been able to find? And I said, you know, I'm sitting here in your studio, and if I got on a bicycle right now and I rode for 5 minutes, I could be on the grounds of a 9th-century Gothic castle with 20-foot-thick walls and just this magnificent piece of feudal history of this country. And there isn't a single place in this entire country where I can study the arts that were used in that castle.
Mm.
And that, unfortunately, when we look at martial arts in the West, we tend to leave them entirely and utterly behind when they become obsolete in combat.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the more traditional cultures, not all Asian cultures do this, but in the more traditional Asian cultures, they tend to hang on to those things as sort of connections to that blood relationship they had with warriors of the past, which is
mm-hmm.
to our benefit. But again, I think that everybody that I know who studies martial arts would just love to climb onto the back of a 2,500-pound Belgian horse, put on 200 pounds of armor, and go barreling down a field at 40 miles an hour and blast somebody with a lance. Talk about martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't get a chance
exactly.
to do that. That's not the average martial arts school experience with the Korean flag stapled to the wall. You know, it's just,
right.
It's not what most of us get to do. So
right.
It would be nice if we could go and study those kinds of things. So the horseback archery, horseback, I mean, all of the horseback stuff is completely absent from most martial artist education.
That bums me out, because I would love to learn that.
Oh, it's fantastic. Fighting in water. A lot of the training I did with Filipino teachers, we would go up to our neck in the water and work at the blades under the water. So, you really get a sense of how to move correctly so that the blade doesn't cavitate as it goes through the water, and you get a nice smooth line of movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's magical. And, you know, it's kind of difficult to have a pool in my martial arts school, so it's sort of an absent part of training. So
wow.
So there's so much more that we could do, and unfortunately, because the art is basically predominated by individuals such as myself who are self-reliant. They build their schools themselves. They have a modest number of students that they really put their focus into, and by virtue of the financial reality of that kind of a circumstance, they are limited in what they can do with regard to expanding their students' horizons. And it would be nice if we could find a circumstance where the rivalries could be dropped, egos could be dropped, the insecurities could be dropped, and some really highly skilled martial artists could pool their resources and create an organization, an institute, a college, if you will, where we could take the students beyond our own understanding of the art so that they could be as inspired as I was when I was 6 years old.
Very cool. And I hope that comes sooner or later, where the egos and the rivalries get dropped and we all can just, you know, shut up and train. Shut up and train.
I just recently went to Hawaii, and I was going there for a vacation. It had been a long time since I'd gone on vacation, and I gave my brother, Bart Richardson, a call, and I said, hey, I'd love to come out and just, you know, drop into a Philippine martial arts school and just guest teach, so I won't charge anything. Just love to do it for the fun of it, just to break out of my normal routine. And he said, well, let me get on the phone and see what I can come up with. And after about 2 weeks of trying, he called me up just before I left to fly out to Kauai. He said, you know, 25, 30 years ago when we were training, we were lamenting how closed-minded people were back then. And the fact is, they are more closed-minded now than they were then.
Wow.
And
wow.
The cliquishness and the barriers and the politics have, in a lot of ways, gotten worse. And it's a sad testament to the people that are doing the art. The art itself is essentially devoid of any issues. So it's the individuals that bring their psychological maladies to it and bring it down, in my opinion. Because especially the Filipino March, could be so much more popular. They could be so much more influential in the martial arts world. There's so much to offer. They are, in my opinion, after studying a lot of different martial arts all my life, they are the most comprehensively direct and effective martial arts and the easiest to teach. I find I can make people very dangerous in a very short period of time with the Filipino martial arts. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a shame to see the rivalries. I mean, you know, it's one thing to see the rivalries in the Philippines, and then it's another thing to see rivalries of Filipino martial arts practitioners that have never been to the Philippines.
Yeah.
You know, and it just makes me like go WTF? What's going on?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. You studied some Japanese martial arts. You were mentioning earlier about Gordon Dovasola. By the way, I met many times over the years, a long, long time ago. He was quite a wonderful guy. But I've met plenty of big Caucasian guys teaching Japanese martial arts and speaking with a broken Japanese accent when they did it. And I've met guys in Canada who are teaching Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and they're speaking with a broken Portuguese accent, and yet they're very good English. It's Japanophiles, it's Brazilianophiles. I've seen Filipino guys American guys start teaching with a broken Filipino accent. It is for lack of their own fully developed self and self-esteem that they rapidly go towards something else to identify themselves with, and they become, at best, a very poor imitation of that. And to us people who have such a passion and a love for all aspects of the martial arts, it's almost like a sickness and a sad testament to the people who are doing the art. And I don't really mean to come down on this. I certainly don't want this talk to be about how awful the martial arts are, because this is only a small sliver. But it is out there, and what I feel bad about, or what I lament, is the young man or woman who walks into a school like that and gets misled and is taught something that is basically without soul and without heart, and perhaps somebody who might have been a phenomenal teacher and somebody who would have expanded the art beyond anything you or I could imagine will have their path truncated and ruined by somebody who took the art so that they could be recognized and seen as somebody important, and yet they didn't really have the heart and the soul of it. And it's a sad thing. I've seen it too many times over the years, and it is something that I lament greatly. So.
Yeah, so do we. I know Bob's seen a lot of stuff go down. I've seen a lot of stuff go down basically because of ego and, you know, stupid crap, basically.
Yeah, that's it.
I don't think I could put it better myself.
Yeah, just stupid crap, you know. Well,
yeah.
In fact, one of our listeners on the chat board just said, it's the same to see that in any martial art, and then quote-unquote, can't we just all get along?
Yeah.
So.
It's kind of funny because when we talk constantly about, it's written on my wall. You might be able to see it right in the middle of the wall. It says, the art is relationship. That's really what
it
is.
Martial
arts is about love, but art, when we talk about art in martial arts, we're not talking about an aesthetic. We're not talking about how pretty it is or how alluring or how attractive it might be. What we're talking about is the same thing that a painter or a photographer is focusing on. He's focusing on getting his knowledge of the craft of painting or photography out of the way of his expression so that he can get his idea and his feeling onto that paper, that canvas, devoid of any impurities that would be left by the remnants of the craft being there. So as a martial artist, what we want to be is in a totally untainted direct relationship with our opponent, untainted by stylistic beliefs or limitations, but just a pure and direct in the moment relationship. That is the art of martial arts. And when you're trying to superimpose a stylistic bent on that relationship, well, it's going to fall apart at a certain point. Bruce Lee was yelling and screaming about this 45 years ago. So the MMA craze has revealed to a degree what that is, but it has its own issues as well, because it isn't a full mixture of martial arts, and because it's been sportified, it can't really define things. As soon as you put a glove on, as soon as you put a mouthpiece on, as soon as you create a set arena, all of those things impact the arts. Certain arts would never function in that reality, whereas they might function very well on a muddy hillside in the Philippine jungle. So it has to be applied in the way that it was designed to be applied. Mm-hmm. I've oftentimes said kickboxing is great, but not when your pants are around your ankles in a bathroom stall.
So, right.
And if I know what I'm doing, that's where I'm going to attack you. So mm-hmm. we need to think of how the opponent is going to bring his problems to us. He's the problem creator. We as martial artists are problem solvers. So it's unlikely that a samurai is going to show up next week and attack me. So it's as much as it can be fun and culturally enriching to study that exactly the way it was done then. If I want to be a martial artist of the 21st century, I need to bring that knowledge and utilize it to help me to solve the problem that I'm facing now.
Mm-hmm.
So not have some fantasy that I'm in the 17th century.
Exactly. And I think that's where a lot of the problem is with many practitioners. Did we just open up a can of worms when I said that, Bob? I don't know.
Thank you very much.
I pretty much just said that people had a problem. No, but I shouldn't say all, but some, you know.
I said before that it's a small sliver of people.
It's a small sliver of people. And the problem being is that, you know, like you call them like Japanophiles and, you know, Kung Fu files and Wushu files. You know, there's all sorts of files out there, and they tend to think that, you know, because that's all that they're exposed to, that if they don't see anything else that looks like their thing or their movement, that, well, it's not going to work. They just automatically put that in their head, and they make it not work for them.
Of course.
In their head, because they make it not work. And, you know, exactly what you said, you know, it's a sad, I almost call it a disease. It's almost a disease. It's a sad disease.
I would absolutely agree that it's a disease. Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, I've had people walk into my school and tell me they're instructors in arts that were taught by teachers that I actually studied with. And I work with them for 5 minutes and then remind them that my most beginner instructors are senior to them. And yet, these people, certainly you've had some traditional martial arts background, you know that the mm-hmm. tradition is you don't open a school until you're at least a third-degree black belt.
Mm-hmm.
But I've known people who open their school and they have their blue belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Right.
Now, I'm all for free market enterprise and all that, but what? How much heart and cultural background and history and everything else is going to be present in that blue belt's instruction?
Mm-hmm.
It's just not, you cannot shortcut it. I've been training almost 37 years now. There's no way that somebody who's been training for 10 years can come anywhere close to the depth that I can bring to the art. It's just
mm-hmm.
not possible. But they might be very technically skilled. They might be very good coach for an athlete or something like that. But if you want to talk about how can we talk about the anthropology, the history, the science, the anatomy, the physiology, all of it, well, that's what I've spent my life doing. It's not just how to make a fist.
Right, yeah, and the disease, as we call it.
It wouldn't be interesting to me. I must say it wouldn't be interesting to me still to this day if it was only about hurting people.
Right, exactly.
Right?
And, yeah, and like you said earlier, or like we were talking about earlier, about, you know, how a closed-mindedness, so to speak, within the arts is sort of a disease. It just behooves me how you know, people can do that, like coming up to your school and saying, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know,
yeah.
And then you tell them like it is, and then they're still blah, 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 blah. And it's like, oh, gosh, what do you do with people like that, right? All right,
well,
I'm going to hand the mic over to Bob here in a sec.
Yeah. Hopefully I think they'll find an opportunity for themselves. It's going to have to be like alcoholism. They're going to have to hit bottom and figure it out for themselves. It's basically
yeah.
nothing you can say. So.
Yeah, or in some cases they need to get their ass kicked and then figure it out.
Yeah, and you know, unfortunately, that is a problem that we go back to that might makes right. And
mm-hmm.
I've met teachers. I've had some Philippine teachers who were in their late 80s when I started with them. And it's not reasonable to say that if I bring in a kid who's 27 and been on steroids for 5 years and he's 100 pounds heavier than this old man and can probably knock his head into next week, it's not
yeah.
reasonable for me to say that because he's tougher that he's correct.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I've seen Takoy Kenyette kick people's butts. You know,
yeah.
that are like 200 pounds, and he'll just laugh at them. Are you trying to hit me? And he'll just throw them on the floor. And it's like, what are you, you know, and we have to sit there and go, what are you doing? Are you stupid? Why are you trying
you
to get one over on
the
treadmill?
You got the voice down perfect. That was a perfect Kenyette. I love it.
Are you trying to hit me? Oh, gosh. You know, 94 years old, I can still kick butt. You know,
yeah.
and the bigger they are,
yeah.
the more he enjoys it. Oh, okay. Back to you, Bob. Sorry.
Oh, my turn. Well, girl, I have two questions for you. One, I've always been curious, because last time I saw you was at a Ted Lukai seminar in Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
And every time Girl Ted referenced back in the day, he always referred to you. And I was wondering, were you training partners with Guru? Were you student teacher? Were you just brothers within the martial arts? What was your
just
relationship
brother.
With Guru Ted?
Just brothers. We got along really well. I think, I mean, we were sort of polar opposites. He was a little guy and I was a big guy. And I think we both saw the strengths and limitations of those things. A lot of martial arts are designed for very small people. And I walk in like a big stilt at 6'3" and I had to modify the way that I would move to make it work for me a lot of times. And yet I also had, you know, 8 inches of reach on Ted. So Ted was, in my opinion, one of the best people who ever came out of that group. He was just such a great spirit and such a good soul when it came to the art. He also didn't feel that it was only about hurting people. Yet he was very precise in his technical explanation of technique and just building an arsenal as a martial artist. But to him, I think the thing that he brought to class certainly was the camaraderie, the joy of the relationship with the students and the fellow students. And you just wanted to be in the class. And that particular time period when my training partner was Burton Richardson and Ted was still alive and that whole time period, to me, is sort of the golden era for me. It's the open-mindedness, the open arms when it came to training. If you walked into any of these guys' schools, you would instantly be welcomed, and they would want to hear your contribution. They would want to see what you could bring to them and advance in their own learning, and when they would want to share with you what they could teach. And that isn't as strong as it used to be. I've been in a lot of schools where it's about we're better than you and we're tougher than you. And again, might does not make right. I have a student who's been with me for almost 20 years, and he can mop the floor with most martial artists I've ever met, and yet he's still learning from me all the time. And it's not about being the toughest guy. So that's
very cool. Now, I'm sorry.
Say it one more time.
Well, I was reading on your website. You have a very interesting philosophy. One of the things we battle with in a combat situation is stress. And from what I was reading about you, you know how to teach your students how to combat that. How do you teach your students how to combat stress?
Oh, again, how long is this show? I've got to make this into a tiny kernel. first of all, you cannot be wholly prepared for anything that is completely unexpected. So one element of the stress is that you're going to have to develop in your art, in your I don't even like to use the term art, in your capabilities, let's say. You're going to have to develop the ability to adapt. Adaptation, being in the present relationship at all times and being able to continuously adapt, has to be the foundation. It's not in case my plan goes badly, then I'll adapt. Your plan is going to go badly. So adaptation has to be your plan. So that's the first thing. So we build in the idea of contingencies all the time. Everything is a contingency plan. What if, what if, what if, what if, what if. Got to be prepared for the worst. So then it gets down to some physiological things, some breath control things that you can do to keep your heart rate down, to keep yourself calm, to keep yourself from gassing out. So it is all teachable. It can certainly prepare somebody who has done the work and has put the time in. There aren't any shortcuts. It's not easy. It's hard work. If I'm preparing somebody to go to Afghanistan, for example, it's something where I've really got to push the stress inoculation training and get their mindset shifted so that they can actually deal with it. And that is not an easy thing to do. It really requires that they commit themselves to it. As I can come at you and yell and scream at you and upset you and all that, and all that will do is exactly that. It will upset you and shake you up, but that's not preparation. Anybody with a loud voice can bark at somebody. That's not the point. You can do it without yelling. You can do it without screaming. You can do it simply by putting their mind into the right frame and then creating training circumstances and situations where they can test that. And they can develop then, I don't know if it's mentioned in my website, but they can develop what I like to refer to as prowess. It's a word that is often forgotten in the martial arts, and it's really an important word for martial artists. Prowess is the development of courage based on skill.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody can run into battle and be killed. That doesn't really take any courage. That just takes foolishness. But to be able to walk into a very dire circumstance and be able to handle yourself effectively, that requires prowess, which is, again, courage based on skill. You know that you can do it. Now go and do it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Very cool. Very cool. Now,
the Philippine martial arts offers a lot in that regard because it's so focused on nobody ever comes into a Philippine martial arts school and says, hit me with your best shot. Nobody does that. Nobody expects a real knife fight to last for 12 rounds, 3 minutes per round. It's mm-hmm. ludicrous to develop a martial art that would take that long to reach not an actual victory, but just a decision. So So when we're talking about real martial arts, and I define that as an art that has actually been used in warfare, well, you're talking about something that needs to basically get the business done in seconds. Because it's not one-on-one, it's not a duel, it's one-on-many. It's many mm-hmm. on many. You have a moment. You cannot, if you're in a five-man rifle squad, you cannot drop to the ground and see if you can submit this guy. You've just removed yourself from an incredibly important equation, and you've probably sentenced your fellow soldiers to death.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to look at it in a realistic way and adapt accordingly. You might indeed be able to beat this guy, but it really doesn't matter. We're not in this to test our mettle to see who's better. We're only mm-hmm. in this to make sure that we go home and see our wives or our daughters and our children and to survive, to tell about it when we're old. So that's what the art is about. It isn't about who's better.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Very cool. Now, I've been looking at, I've just been browsing through your website, and wow, there's a lot of arts at your school. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your curriculum and what would you say is unique about your curriculum?
Oh, boy. That would be a better question to ask my students. I'm on the inside looking out, so I've been in it for so long. To me, it's just an old hat.
Well, if any of your students are listening, 347-677-0699, give us a call, folks. You know, if you're a student of Guru Makita, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to get your take on what it's like studying
like
at the school.
That. That's really interesting.
Yeah,
I think the first thing is that my curriculum certainly is always evolving. If you trained with me 10 years ago and you come back into the school, you can't possibly walk in and think, oh, I'm just going to be able to jump right back in and I'll be perfectly fine. No, you'll be lost utterly because we change all the time. Every teacher that influences me, every insight that I find through my own exploration, and I'm really adamant about the art being taught to us by ourselves. We are our own teachers. Instructors and masters that we may have an opportunity to train with only provide guideposts and inspiration. The teaching is really what we do. So beyond that, it certainly is evolving all the time. I'm constantly trying to bring it down to what can you use right now? Not in Aikido, for example, there are a lot of techniques that are referred to as 30-year techniques.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something that you teach to guys who are headed to Afghanistan next Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
So we need immediate usable techniques, what are sometimes called field expedient techniques, techniques that we can come up with on the spot when everything has gone bad. I oftentimes say to my students that martial arts are designed to work effectively when it's pouring rain, it's icy, you've got a flu, a broken arm. Now the art has to actually function. Yeah, you're a woman, you're wearing 6-inch heels. Who's more likely to be attacked? That woman. Well, she needs to be able to utilize that circumstance effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole idea of making it really, you mentioned the idea of exigency. If you've studied Philippine martial arts and you've decided to arm yourself, but because of your social training, your social indoctrination, you feel that it is enough for you to simply carry your really nice, expensive Spyderco knife in your purse. Well, I guarantee you it will be in your purse when they find your body and make the little tape lying around your body. So if the weapon is actually in your hand, then it's going to be useless. So all of the awareness and everything else that comes with actually knowing that it's time to be armed, it's time to set aside, for lack of a better way of putting it, my humanity and step mm-hmm. outside of the bounds of civilization for a moment, with a 21st century person's mind to make proper decisions in doing so. If you're not ready to do all those things, then do tennis or something like that. Don't do martial arts. So.
Exactly. It's funny that you mentioned the Spyderco in the purse. I've met too many women that they take a single firearms course. They buy a nice expensive gun and they keep that Glock in their purse.
Yeah.
And they feel really safe with that Glock in their purse.
Yeah,
but,
it's an illusion. Yeah.
Yeah, but when the shit hits, I guess I can say it now. When the shit hits the fan.
Yep.
You know, I haven't yet met anyone that was quick enough to unbuckle a purse.
No.
And draw a bead on somebody.
My students will carry a little, like a Spyderco or some other kind of knife that will be tucked in their waistband. And almost invariably, I'll say to them, they'll come into class, I'll see their knife sort of peeking out from under their shirt, and I'll be maybe 10 feet away, and I'll say, listen, I'm going to walk towards you. I'm not going to walk fast. I'm not going to run. I'm going to walk towards you. And if I can put my hands on your throat before that knife is open and in your hand, I want you to consider the reality of what that means. And almost invariably, I can walk toward them and have my hands on their throat before they can ever get that knife out.
Mm-hmm. They should have gotten that knife out while you were talking.
Exactly.
Why did you think of that?
What will oftentimes preclude people from doing that is their social conditioning. And we talk all the time in my school about social contracts and how we are impeded by those things and oftentimes hamstrung by those things to make intelligent choices and to make intelligent decisions ahead of time. How often have we heard as teachers that if we do such and such a thing, well, now we're being paranoid and we're bringing violence to us. Mm-hmm. And that's such foolishness. I don't put on a seatbelt because I intend to get into a car accident.
Mm-hmm. I love Guru's thinking, Bob. This is the funnest conversation
me, girl,
I've had in a while.
Well, you know what really stuck with me, Guru, after all these years, as good as you are, the one thing, when I was studying with you at Barnsdale Art Park in the city of Hollywood, you said to me, if you have a knife out And you want to cut me, you better be able to run faster than I can to catch me.
Yeah, yeah.
I do that all the time.
Track and field always beats knife fighting.
Yeah.
Right.
Elbows and shoe soles. Nike foo, yeah.
And you know how many times have I had different karate, aikido, jiu-jitsu, instructors say to me, in fact, the most recent one was a Brazilian jiu-jitsu teacher who said, well, I will just, it's always my favorite preface
yeah.
to anything, I'll just take you down and choke you out. And I said, let's do it this way. I'll lay down. You can get in the best position you can manage, and I'll just have my knife tucked into my waistband, and you just say start, and then we'll
mm-hmm.
see what happens. Because I can put a knife into the hands of an idiot, and he has the advantage over any martial artist in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Very true. Very true. And a lot of martial artists forget that. Even within the, I've met a few people within the Filipino martial arts that go, oh, well, you know, if they're untrained, I can beat them. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, if you're looking for a specific style of movement, you know, you're good at that. You know, but,
yeah.
you know, here,
he's
going to
be unpredictable. If he's untrained,
yeah.
he's going to be unpredictable. Yeah.
Those are the people that scare the mess out of me, are the people with no training. It's like, oh, my God.
You mentioned before about my curriculum, because it's
mm-hmm.
something that is difficult from a teaching standpoint, because I know that part of teaching, the very first step of teaching is to make the person safe so that other people can practice with them without being hospitalized, especially when we're talking about weapons.
Mm-hmm.
But on a certain level, I feel bad that I am essentially stealing from them for a time their unpredictableness, their own timing. I'm taking those elements away from their control so that we can safely practice. And
mm-hmm.
that actually, on a certain level, is a disservice.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, I would actually rather be able to just say, well, now that you have this weapon, here's how you attack. It is how I will train a Marine or a soldier who's going into combat. I will never teach him exercises that are drills.
Mm-hmm.
Because ain't nobody going to be drilling with him in Afghanistan.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
It's all going to be about how can I bring that weapon to bear as brutally, effectively as I possibly can in as short a period of time as I can. And that
mm-hmm.
actually doesn't take a heck of a lot of training. It mostly takes anatomical training and an understanding of what that anatomy will produce. And my students will oftentimes talk about bathing in their opponent's blood, because that's
mm-hmm.
really what it's going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you've faced that reality, then don't bother with this kind of art, because that is the reality. And we as escrimadores or escrimadoras need to understand that fundamentally this is about hacking a person apart.
Mm-hmm.
So the stick is a training weapon for the blade. But
mm-hmm.
you know from training with Kenyeti what the stick alone can do. Imagine if it was a bolo.
Yeah, right? Oh, my gosh.
Right, right.
Hey,
girl, we have a caller that would like to talk to you. Do you want to take a call?
Sure.
Cool.
Let me connect it, and we're good.
All right.
Code 951-345. You are on live on the Dynamic Dojo with Guru Mark Makita. Do you have a question for Guru?
Hello.
Yeah, hello.
951.
Good afternoon.
Oh, I'm online. No, I don't have a question, a statement.
You bastard, Tony. How come you're not in class?
well, I tell you, Mark, after eating my dinner of juice and bread, I was just too tired and sleepy to drive 4 hours to see you, my friend.
This is Anthony Ortega, a longtime friend and martial arts brother and student of mine. He's a tremendous guy. So
thanks for calling, Tony.
Well,
thank you for the invite.
Thank you for the invite. I just have to say that Mark is, and I'm not an expert in martial arts by any stretch of the word, but I have seen a lot of martial arts and been around many martial arts myself, and Mark is the most knowledgeable and our most articulate person that I've ever met in the martial arts community, fantastic teacher. And you guys are speaking about his curriculum, and
mm-hmm.
I certainly can't write a thesis on it, but I can tell you this. When you go to his school, you're going to experience something that you've never experienced in probably any other school. You're not going to see katas and things like that. Not to say that those are bad. I come from a traditional karate background myself and did thousands of, you know, practices with katas. But you're going to see the most realistic type of martial art there. And it's very, very diverse. And you get blown away because you think you're in an absolute museum of weaponry. I mean, who has, like, a European knight lance? I'm not talking, like, a three-foot small scale. I mean, a real lance. That, I don't know. How long was that, Mark? My God. It blew me away.
12 feet long.
Yeah. It was just incredible. And yeah, make a long story short, how I met Mark, and I'm going to not mention the name of the instructor that we shared, but nobody would want to train with the guy. And for some reason, he chose me. And I didn't stop training with him ever since. And because Mark's very, he's like a brain surgeon. He's like, oh, my God, safety is everything. And I even to this day hear him talk to people about safety and not smashing his hands and whatnot. And when we were training with about 30 or 40 other students, clashing sticks, they were just crickets. You can just hear our sticks clashing. We would be shredding those sticks, brother, in that school. And I couldn't turn away from the guy ever since. 2004, the best year of my life.
Very
I remember
cool.
that. You bought a pair of sticks in the school, as I recall. And I think we trained for maybe 20 minutes, and you had two basically pairs of impromptu nunchaku in your hand. They're just broken in half.
Exactly. And I want to have the permission from Mark, but I'm going to ask Mark, are you going to speak of your latest project a few months back?
Oh, is this just so I can tell him that you're in it?
No, not at all.
Okay. Somebody's talking about a film that I just finished shooting about a month ago. It's in the post-production right now, editing and sound and music and everything else. It's a film called Terms and Conditions. I'm the central character, and the bad guy is played by Tom Sizemore from Saving Private Ryan and Heat and films like that. So it should be coming out in January. I don't know where it's going to come out. It might just be on Netflix. It might be in the theater. You never know. That's a lottery, so you never know. So. But it was about a $2 million film that we finished about, like I said, about a month ago. We finished the photography.
Well, I just wanted to stop by and say hi, Mark. It's great to hear you. This is a fantastic show. I'm a fan now, and I look forward to seeing you, brother. And I really, really enjoyed it. I thought I was just going to, you know, sit in and listen for a minute, but I haven't been able to get off the phone. So great show, and thank you to your host there. I'm going to friend you guys up on Facebook, and I hope to see you soon, Mark.
Talk to you soon, brother.
Thank you, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.
Now, girl, you know, growing up in a JKD environment, there are certain arts that we've grown accustomed to being taught at Jeet Kune Do school. You know, Jun Fan, JKD, Kali, Wing Chun, Sabat, Muay Thai, and so forth. Now, you've expounded upon that. You've got some arts within your school that aren't what would be classified as taught at a typical JKD school, like Hungar, Pakwa, Shingi,
yeah.
Western yeah. fencing. Do you teach all these arts, or do you have a qualified staff that teach for you? And can your students specialize in any one aspect of your curriculum?
Okay, I don't know how many questions that is, but I'll try to answer them all. let's see. Do I have a qualified staff? First of all, I hate walking into the Tom Jones School of Martial Arts and never being able to actually study with Mr. Tom Jones. So I teach all of the classes in my school. I don't have anybody who teaches for me. I do have people who are qualified to teach, but it's the Makita School of Martial Arts, so when students go to study there, guess who they get to study with. So so that's one thing. With regard to the specific arts, I will oftentimes cross-reference arts, especially the arts that have less directly applicable combative skills, like Xingyi, Bagua don't really have a lot of direct combat application, but they do have a lot of principle-based things that are really excellent for grounding and power extension and so forth. So fencing-wise, we use a lot of fencing, a lot of Western fencing. I think it's one of the most comprehensively evolved arts, 350 or 400 years of evolution. Very, very well thought out. The terminologies are very accurate. Western terminologies don't tend to have any frou-frou stuff in them. There's no spiraling energy principles or chi or any of that stuff. So it's just basically how to run somebody through 3 feet of steel. So I teach a lot of fencing principle, both technical, how to do it with a fencing-type weapon like a rapier or a saber, and we also apply it directly to the stick and to the knife and to empty hands. Bruce Lee used to say that fencing, or Jeet Kune Do is fencing without a foil. His brother was a saber fencer and influenced him greatly in his development of JKD. So, but with regard to teaching the individual arts and can my students specialize, I tend to not have them specialize in the more obscure arts like Hungar Kung Fu, for example. They can certainly become very fully qualified escrimadores. They can certainly go very, very in-depth in the Filipino martial arts, more so than in most schools, I would say, in the world. Study with a large number of Philippine teachers and continue to seek them out to this day. So I basically share their voices and their backgrounds and their influence with the students completely so that my students will have complete access to them. I also bring those teachers in and have my students study with them directly whenever I can. So, but with regard to Junfan martial arts, I teach that as part of the empty hand curriculum in school. It could include anything from Northern Shaolin Kung Fu to Sabat to Kyuksul Wan type kicking to Muay Thai type kicking. And in Junfan, the Junfan martial arts were basically just delineations of one person's evolution. And I've had, by virtue of Bruce's influence and the barriers he broke down, I've had access to and the opportunity to train in many more martial arts than he was ever able to train in. And it's to his credit that I'm able, and many other people have been able to do that. But I don't necessarily teach all of those things fully. You're certainly not going to come in and see any Hungar Kung Fu forms being done in the school, for example.
Oh, very cool. Now, many years ago, I was a fencer, and I was teaching at a fencing school here in Burbank. Well, one of Guru Ted's students had a father-in-law from the Philippines that was a very good fencer. And I made a grave mistake. He decided he was going to pick up a foil and face me. Well, I carried and reposed it and stuck him. He spanked me like you wouldn't believe. I didn't mean any disrespect by it, but he thought it was disrespectful that I was able to get in on him because I was a fence and nobody else was. Oh, yeah. Wow. Now, Rusty's heard this story. Because of my escrima background with Guru Ted, yourself, and a couple other people, Mark Stewart, I did a fencing tournament, a saber tournament, about, 20 years ago. Never studied saber in my life. Redondo came in very handy. I came in out of like 20. I was just redondoing everybody.
See, if you'd gone back to old fencing, where you were actually using a real saber, which is quite a terrifying weapon compared to a sportified saber, which is basically the end of a small fishing rod. A real saber will cut your legs right off, and the technique you're talking about in saber fencing would be referred to as a mulane, which is just basically a big, large, circular slash. We would call it a redondo in the Philippine martial arts, but you probably noticed that in saber fencing, cuts to the legs are actually outlawed. And part of the reason for that is because they're so difficult to block. And in any martial arts school, they would say, well, that's really difficult to block. Let's develop a really effective way to block it. But in sportified fencing, they just make it illegal. So it's always a problem anytime you sportify anything.
Yeah.
Why I'm not actually a fan of sportified escrima. The only kind of sport I think should be done is maybe some racquetball glasses, a good quality padded stick, a mouthpiece, a groin protector, and some very, very minimal gloves, and then go full out.
I agree. It's funny. It's like I've got some friends here in Seattle that have a historical fencing club out here, and sometimes we just get together for drinks and watch, you know, Olympic fencing.
Yeah.
And to hear them just kind of, to hear them go, "Oh my God, did he just jump at him? Are you serious?" It's so much fun.
Yeah. So when you get real rapier, everything changes. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And yeah, I like watching any kind of fencing. But kind of like you, you know, I'll watch sport fencing, like Olympic fencing. And I don't know. Maybe I just don't understand it. I understand why they're tethered to a little line, but you know, just some of the techniques like jumping. Why would you jump at somebody? You know, and I don't know. It's maybe because I don't understand it. But I agree in that, you know, the sport can take away a lot of the original combat practicality of it, unless they understand the difference between, okay, now I'm playing a sport, but all too often you meet too many people.
Some of them genuinely do. Some of them genuinely do know the difference. There's a gentleman you're very close to being in Seattle, and I think I know the group that you probably train with in Seattle, but there's a school up in Vancouver, Canada. The school is called Academy Duello. He's a very good friend of mine. His name is Devin Borman. Really a scholar of real fencing, rapier, side sword, et cetera. And he's just a tremendous, tremendous martial artist and very eloquent, very, very just a brilliant guy. And also, you'd think he lived in the 17th century when you met him, not because he puts on, you know, he doesn't pretend to be anything. He has embodied his art. And if you get a chance to go up there, certainly tell him that I suggested it. He'll be thrilled to have you come. He loves working with martial artists. He loves working with people from Eskrima. And if you get a chance to zip up to Vancouver, definitely drop in and meet Devin. So
definitely,
I don't recommend very many martial arts teachers, by the way. It's hard to recommend a very small handful, I must say. But I certainly recommend him as a teacher.
Very cool. Yeah, you bet. And the next time up there, I'll see if I can visit.
Be up there for the weekend of the 21st of September teaching. I usually go up every month to teach. So it'll be fun to drop into Seattle sometime and teach there.
Yeah. You know, if I had the space, I would definitely bring you down.
Always attractive.
Yeah, you know, definitely I would bring you down. I'm teaching out of a rented room at the moment, but oh well.
Well, earlier. That's what I was saying earlier, that is the problem for most teachers, that they are limited in their financial reality. So.
Yeah. My financial reality is like there is no reality right now. Bob knows exactly what
fantasy.
I'm talking about. Yeah. Financial anything is a fantasy for me, so Bob knows what I'm talking about.
You know, some of the best training I had was in somebody's garage, somebody's basement room. I mean, it almost never was the big, fancy school with all the money. It was always somebody's backyard. I mean, it was something really minimalist, really, really, really almost Spartan in its reality. And those were the times I remember with the greatest fondness.
Awesome. Well, yeah, you know, if you're ever in Seattle, do look us up. We'd love to have you. That'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we only have about 5 minutes left to our show. So as a last note for our listeners, what are the ways that our listeners can contact you if they're ever in your neck of the woods?
Well, certainly the website, fightology.com. My personal cell phone number, I'm probably doing a terrible thing here, but my personal cell phone number is the number for the school. So people can always call me directly. My email is on the site as well, so they can email me directly. You can certainly friend me on Facebook. Just go to Mark Makita, or you can go to the Makita School of Martial Art, which is just a public site that they can go to. So I'm really easy to find. So and I welcome all kinds of students from all kinds of backgrounds.
Very cool. And one last question. What if you had only 2 minutes to talk to someone about giving them maybe some advice on studying any martial art, what would you say to them?
Oh, boy, you didn't give me any parameters, so I'm going to have to spitball. I don't know if they're 9 years old. I don't know if they're...
Yeah. 2 minutes is the only parameter. So if someone came up to you and asked, you know, I'm looking at getting into martial arts. What do you think?
Okay, I can answer that. Most people will have some kind of a reason. It'll oftentimes be they like the camaraderie of it. They want to be part of a group. They want the social interaction, or they want the exercise. But fundamentally, I think all people who come to martial arts and stay for any appreciable length of time came because they were afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, whether they immediately recognize and can articulate that fear, or it just comes to them through their practice, and they realize that the driving force behind their training is a genuine fear that they carry with them, well, we can address that. That is what a true martial arts school is for. It is to arm you against that fear. You will not be a victim of it and crippled by it for your life. Can put some tools in your hands, show your strengths, show your weaknesses, not only show you how to survive and be victorious in a combative situation, but also how to run away and not beat yourself to death because you ran.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding what real courage is, understanding what real reality is, not some fantasy. As much as I was influenced by Bruce Lee, what most people think of when they think of Bruce Lee is the fantasy that was created in the movies, not the real person.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to keep in mind what the reality is. What would happen if you're a 110-pound woman with orange heels on and you want to go into an alley with some guy who has bad intentions and a knife? There's not going to be a fantasy there, not for you at least. So facing those realities and doing it in a very straight, cold, honest, genuine way, and then giving that person some real tools, psychological tools, physical tools, tactical tools, so that they can make some intelligent, prudent choices in the moment, that's what I would encourage them to do. And it wouldn't just have to be me. I'm certainly not the only voice or the only source of that information, but they should open their minds to all kinds of sources. So.
Very cool. I hope our listeners take that into account.
I hope that was somewhat coherent.
Wow, well, what a great show. It never fails. Like, you know, at the beginning of a show, Sifu Bob and I always go, wow, I don't know if we're going to be able to get through all these questions, which we didn't. We still had like 3 or 4 other questions that we wanted to get to. And all of our shows always, you know, always have great guests like yourself that really make this show fun. Because, you know, Sifu Bob and I never really want to have just a strict interview. We want to, you know, have so that way we're all just sitting around having coffee or a drink and just kind of like, you know, shooting the breeze type of thing. So, yeah, so thank you.
I'm happy to come back again. I'm happy to come back again anytime.
That would be great. I think a part 2 would be awesome. What do you think, Bob?
Sure.
Yeah, I think we should do that. So once we get some dates going, then we'll definitely let you know. So thank you
Absolutely.
So much,
you guys
Mark,
are great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, girl.
And Bob.
Have a good evening.
Yo, you too, sir.
Thank you very much. And Bob, who do we have next week again? I'm so lost. These last couple weeks.
Next week we have our guest, William Christopher Ford, and I am
bringing on
Susan DeCarl to talk a little bit about from the behind the scenes of last night's event, the Martial Arts History Museum Hall of Honor. I will have special guest co-host Kimo Kiyoki. And
very
I'm sorry,
cool.
You won't be here, but maybe you'll get a chance to call in, hopefully. And remember, it's our brunch show, so we're on from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. next week.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited. I'm excited about next week's show, but I'm really excited about having Richard Norton on the week after. That's
going
to be a great
show. I'm excited about that, too. I'm kind of bummed out that I'm going to be missing out talking with William. But hopefully during lunch from the... seminar from studying with my Tai Chi grandmaster. Hopefully during lunch I can at least pop in and say hello.
Well, and hopefully you won't just be teasing us again this time like you did last time. I'll call in and Never called in. I got sort of lonely and bummed out. You know, you weren't online.
Yeah, that's because I was stuck in a Tai Chi ring forever.
Right.
But at least I know we're going to have lunch. That I know. So, yeah, I'll probably be able to call in for, you know, a little bit. And then I'm going to have to get something to eat or I'll be completely grumpy for the rest of the day. So, all right. Well, thank you so much, Bob, for being instrumental in bringing Guru Mark on the show. And thank you, listeners, and thank you, Tony, for calling in. So join us next week for our lunchtime show. I'm not going to be here, but Kimo and Sifu Bob will. And please tell Kimo I said thank you. I don't think I've met him in person yet, I don't think. But tell him thank
you.
No, you
haven't, but he did a great job last time, and I'm sure he'll do a great job next week. Very cool guy. And William Christopher Ford, our guest, and Kimo have worked together on movie sets before, so they know each other. We're going to have a great time.
Awesome. Well, we will talk to you all next time. Have a great evening, everyone. Bye-bye now.